This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
Often there's a cost to plenty, to abundance, and that cost tends to be waste.
Waste. Today's guests on Sea Change Radio are both trying to do something to reduce it. This week, we first speak to Matthew Mazzotta, an artist who's trying to make an impact and raise awareness about one of our more underappreciated byproducts from man's best friend. Then we visit with Jonathan Bloom, the author who spent time working on farms and at a Mickey D's researching his new book on food waste. My guest on Sea Change Radio is conceptual artist Matthew Mazzotta. He's a graduate of MIT's Art, Culture, and Technology program, and he's developed a series of art projects which deal with methane digesters, and they're called the Park Spark Project. He's here to talk about it. Matthew, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you, Alex. Thanks for having me.
What is the Park Spark Project all about?
Well, the Park Spark Project is simply just bringing an older technology to a new context. What I've done here in Cambridge, Massachusetts, is bring a methane digester that they use in India and China and South America to a park in Cambridge. And basically, what a methane digester is, for people that aren't familiar, it's a technology that does one thing, basically. It takes cow manure or some kind of organic matter, and it puts it in an anaerobic environment. So you're putting cow manure into a tank that's closing off all the oxygen. When that happens, the little bugs inside, the microbes, they put off methane, and that methane can be used as a gas to cook with or to light spaces with. So it's basically transforming cow manure into a usable form of energy.
But in this case, you're working with dog parks, right, and handling dog waste, and that probably had a set of unique challenges.
Absolutely. So I'm bringing this technology that's used in houses all over, you know, India, and that's actually where I saw one, saw a bunch of them a couple years before I did the project. I'm bringing it to a dog park in Cambridge. And so we're using all the dog waste that's, you know, being brought to the dog park. People bring their dogs, the dog does its business, and they pick up the waste and they throw it in the garbage can. What I did is replace the garbage can with a methane digester. So people now pick up the dog waste in biodegradable bags and throw it into the digester, the Park Spark Project. The Park Spark Project collects all the methane from the dog waste and burns it in the form of a lamppost.
What do people do with their waste in India that inspired you to look to expand this program to dog parks?
Well, the first time I ever heard about a methane digester was, I don't know, 5-6 years ago. A friend of mine got a grant, a huge grant, he's a microbiologist, to work on a farm size digester. And he was trying to make them scalable. So the more head of cattle you have, the larger this thing would grow. And that took all cow manure and basically took all the methane off of it and fed it back into the grid. So after a couple years, the farm would start paying for itself from all the cow waste. So I thought, wow, that's amazing, free energy just from cow waste. And he said, that's all it is. You basically put this in an anaerobic environment, which means deprive the manure of oxygen. And the little bugs in there, the microbes, they just breathe out methane the same way we breathe out carbon dioxide. So I was like, wow, this is amazing, free energy. Then I started realizing that there's a whole environmental component to the project, which is this. Methane, which is, they're saying now, 30 to 70 times worse than carbon dioxide. So everybody knows carbon dioxide, carbon footprint, carbon this and carbon that. Methane is 30 to 70 times worse as a potent greenhouse gas. But the unique thing is, if you burn it, this CH4 methane, it separates into carbon dioxide and water. So you're actually reducing it by burning it. So I was looking at this and I was like, wow, so it's free energy. And if you burn it, it's better for the environment. And so that totally became mystifying. I was like, how could this be so? And so I just started researching it. I'm like, can this be possible? It's free energy and it's actually good to burn it. And I started realizing that farms are actually being targeted as environmental polluters because they're letting so much methane off into the environment. So actually by burning this, yeah, some of these farms are gaining carbon credits and it's better for the environment. So once I started realizing that, then I was like, I want to figure out this technology. I think there's a project here for me. And I ended up going to India and seeing very small, not what my friend had done on the farm scale, but a very small in the house kind of passive digester. And the woman of the house usually makes the food. So most of her day would be getting firewood from out in the forest, come back, cook the meal. But in this case, if you had a digester, she would collect the waste from the cow, put it inside the digester, and be able to collect the methane off of it and cook right in the house with the methane. Anyways, when I was there in January, the woman we saw, the digester, she picked up the cow manure, mixed it up with water, put it into the tank. And we went in later in the house, and I guess there was enough methane from the previous day. She cooked us chai, and we drank some chai. So that was my first real experience with a passive digester on the scale that the ParkSpark project is.
You're a visual artist who specializes in public interventions, right? What does that mean?
Well, I use that word public intervention. I think about the work I do is not gallery work or inside the museum. I like to work right in the public space. And so when I think about interventions, I think about the work I do is about trying to create situations or space for dialogue or conversation. I want to put something out into the, you know, the world, into the public that actually starts to create an audience, or and people can enter it through curiosity, where someone goes, what is that? How does that work? That's real. That's the kind of space I want to create. And so once I create that space, I want to have it some threads in there that actually talk about some deeper issues, not just, wow, that's a spectacle, that's interesting, wow, look at that, like a parade float, but I actually want to embed it with some meaning. So for me, this project here contained enough curiosity where people are like, wow, that's amazing. That's, that can just create, you know, free energy. But at the same time, it was providing a context to look at it like, yes, this is how our world works. This does have impacts on the environment. And there are, you know, solutions out there that we could get involved in. So that's the kind of work I do.
Can you tell us how the project evolved?
Well, I was interested in digesters from that conversation with my friend years ago. And I just always thought, huh, methane digesters, what an interesting technology. Then I found out it had this environmental component. So then I said, okay, I think there's something here to work with. So I didn't have a clear idea, but I just kept on building digesters. Can I do this? And in the meantime, I went to India and saw that, wow, this is totally how you do a passive one. This is much different how they do it in the United States. In the United States, they have computers and for the big, you know, the bigger digesters. But how do you make a small one? I didn't see a lot of those in America. But once I figured out how to do that, I partnered with a guy named Will Brinton in Maine, who's actually like an expert on digesters and composting. So I took what I learned in India, and he showed me what he had done. And I said, can we mix this and make kind of a hybrid that has no computers, no motors or anything? He said, let's try it. And so we did. And then I realized, okay, I think I got a handle on this. And then I tried to propose it to the city. I said, can we do this with dog waste? And the city said, absolutely no. There's no way that you can bring this into the city. It has gas. It's the public. There's dog waste and there's fire. There's like absolutely no way. And so for about 7 months, I almost became like a professional businessman. I just kept on coming in with these presentations, refining them, just saying, hey, you know, this isn't experimental. People use these in their houses. This is a totally safe application. You know, they don't blow up. They can't blow up. A lot of the misconceptions I've been through, I'd like to present those. And I also like to bring some scientists to help us talk about this. So the city of Cambridge began to be open to me because I was so persistent. And after about 7 months, they finally just said, okay, you've answered every single one of our questions. We agree your design is legitimate. Here's our graces. Go for it. So then I wrote a grant to MIT. They funded it, and I put the thing together, and I debuted it in 2010 in August.
And what does it do?
Basically, what I set up was two tanks. One was the digester, and one was the overflow tank, and then there was one lamppost. So in this particular kind of rendition, people go to the park with their dog. The dog does the business. And then there's a bag provided by the ParkSpark project, which is corn-based. They take that bag, pick up the dog waste, and throw it right into the tank. And there's a little lever there, and they can mix it up with that. And all this tank does is collects all the methane. So all throughout the day, from all the dog waste, the methane is collected. And then at night, it's burned in the lamppost. The way this particular setup is done, and this is what I had to do for the city, in India, you'd put the cow manure into the digester and would flow out the other side, and they'd actually let it flow right into their garden, and they'd plant into it just like a fertilizer. But with dog waste, it's not a fertilizer, and we're inside a city, so I had to have an overflow tank. So this is actually a closed system. People throw dog waste in one tank, and that's the digester collects. But then if there's too much, it flows into this overflow tank, and that's how this system works.
And what happens to the overflow?
That's one of the things I'd like to refine, but what I'm doing right now is just collecting all the waste, and then eventually it had to be pumped And I had to get people that pump a zoo, all the waste from a zoo. So they pump zebra and giraffes and buffalo and all that stuff. I told them, hey, I need a tank pumped. It's only got dog waste in it and corn-based bags. And so they had to pump it. But what I'd like to do is actually try to mix this project with a composting project. So as this thing, all the methane is collected off of it and breaking it down, it flows in the overflow tank. I would love to take that overflow tank and work with it in some kind of composting kind of process where we actually could take that and make it into usable soil for, let's say, non-edible plants. So it would almost be a waste treatment plant. At the same time, it's a kind of a power plant as well. So it's like a open source power production plant and waste treatment, you know, if we were going to bring it all the way out to what it could be.
So what can it be? How do you see this project evolving?
What I'd love to do with this project, though, and kind of where I think it really has its power, is to think about it as an open source power station. So the way we usually deal with dog waste, you pack it up into a plastic bag, you throw that into the garbage, a truck comes by every day, drives it over to the dump, dumps it there, and all the methane goes in the atmosphere. This project takes that same waste and keeps it there at the dog park. And especially if we use it as compost for flower beds, but it uses it, it can collect energy from it. So I thought to myself, hey, it's interesting as a lamp, but, you know, cities have lamps. Which park doesn't have a lamp in the United States? So that's not very useful. So I thought, is there a possibility to use this energy for something else? And so for my kind of vision, yes, it's exciting that we're getting free energy and we're cleaning the environment, but can we take the next step and go, what could we do with this? And I thought about having it be a creative source for the community. So I thought, could it be paired with some kind of urban gardening? Say people are growing corn. Could we take that corn and use it and make popcorn from this heat, you know, from the gas? Or could we make tea from local edible plants and people go on journeys all around the city looking for edible plants? So I was trying to think about this as a catalyst, this free energy as a catalyst for actually doing something and creative in the community, something that we aren't seeing, something that people could get involved with. So that's my idea, is not just to have it as a lamp, but to go one step further and go, okay, we have this free energy source. What would be interesting to unfold inside of our neighborhood that we're not seeing, that someone might be a little privy to, like someone that, yeah, collects edible teas from their neighborhood, or someone that's really into shadow puppets or something else that could really bring the community together under this umbrella of like, wow, we have this new thing that we just realized inside of our community. So what I'm trying to do is work with different communities. So when the Park Spark project came out, it had a website and it also was in the news. So hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people contacted me from all over the country, all over the world, really. And I tried to put people together from the same city on the same email to say, hey, would you guys mind working together and we build this bottom up? So instead of it just being a product that I would sell to them, I said, if you're interested in this, would you want to get together with your other citizens, other people in your neighborhood, come together, talk to your city government, and also fundraise and develop one yourself, and I will help you do that. So right now, I'm trying to do it with 6 different cities around the United States.
And if people want to get involved in the Park Spark project, it's parksparkproject.com, and they can find out more there. Matthew Mazzotta, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Awesome, Alex. Thanks for having me.
Just look at it all. What a beautiful, junky mess of rotten, rusty, mangy, musty, crummy, beautiful trash. Oh, I love trash. Anything dirty or dingy or dusty. Anything ragged or rotten or rusty. Yes, I love trash. If you really want to see something trashy, look at...
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
My next guest on Sea Change Radio is the author of American Wasteland, food waste expert Jonathan Bloom. Jonathan, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us what inspired you to go on this journey to dig up as much inefficiencies and waste in our food system as you could.
I grew up in a house where we really valued food, and I learned to value it both as something to be enjoyed, but as something that you wouldn't just waste or squander. My parents were very good about saving leftovers. So I had that background. And then when I got out into the world a little bit, I was writing about food and had an experience at a food recovery group called DC Central Kitchen. And basically, they're a group that goes out and recovers any food that wouldn't be used but is still perfectly edible. So I'm in the kitchen that day. I'm volunteering. I'm making a vat of pasta. So I had plenty of time to look around and see all the foods that people were bringing by. And these were all really nice-looking foods, rack of ribs, leg of lamb, nice vegetables. And so the epiphany I had that day was, well, what happens in cities and towns that don't have these kinds of food recovery groups, and how much food is wasted there? And that question really got me started on this journey.
Give us an idea about just how much food we as Americans waste. It's probably a pretty tricky thing to calculate, I imagine.
It is, and there hasn't been a fabulous estimate, but the best guess we have is that about 40% of all the food produced in this country isn't consumed. And that's about 160 billion pounds every year that isn't eaten. So a visual for people trying to wrap their heads around that big figure, a good visual is if we were to picture the Rose Bowl in Pasadena, well, every day America wastes enough food to fill that stadium. And not just the playing field, this is the entire 90,000-seat stadium.
Mm. And that's... Is that including crops that are left in the field unharvested?
It does, yeah. That's basically waste from all walks of life.
But that figure of the crops left in the field and produce left unpicked is one of the trickier things to try to calculate, right? You found that as you explored places like lettuce farms in Salinas, right?
Yeah, and it is difficult to quantify something that's essentially not counted. They know how many acres are planted, and they know how many are harvested, but the exact figures are a bit tricky. So that's why I've really called for the USDA to study the topic a bit more and come up with more concrete numbers on just how much is wasted at farms, but also throughout the food chain. 'Cause right now, it's estimates, and you know, what we've seen is when people do come out with hard numbers, like in the UK, it really leads to some significant change where the media latches onto the figures and really makes a splash, and it gets into the public consciousness and really affects change.
Let's start at the beginning of the food chain. What are some of the ways that we could improve efficiency and have less waste in our food system? Would it be more in terms of what we grow or how we grow it or how we pick it?
So starting at the farm level, we really should be harvesting all that we grow. There are so many resources that go into producing our food, mostly oil and water, that the least we could do is actually harvest it. And if we're not going to sell all of it, then that's where we need to have some sort of mechanism to distribute that food to people who need it. And especially these days where there's a real emphasis on getting not just food, but healthy food to those in need. Well, there's a real opportunity there, especially with some of the smaller and medium-sized farms, the places that aren't just growing commodity crops. So I'm not entirely sure of the best way to do that, whether it's the carrot or the stick, whether it's encouraging growers to donate and really beefing up the tax benefits from donation, or whether it's forcing all growers who receive federal funding to actually harvest all that they grow. I mean, there are a couple options there, and that's a discussion for later down the road, but it's a discussion that needs to be had.
And in terms of deciding what these farmers are growing, would that lead to less inefficiencies and less waste if we were a little more targeted with how we grow our food?
Well, it's a tricky discussion because on the one hand, farmers today are basically growing as much as they can, fence row to fence row, sticking with that 1970s idea of just outgrowing the Soviet Union. And that would be great if we were still in a Cold War or if we were better at distributing that excess food. Unfortunately, neither of which are true. So we kind of need to rethink how we do that. So I sort of hinted at one solution would be to actually be better about redistributing food that isn't harvested or isn't sent off the farm. Another idea would be to just have a bit of a rethink on what kinds of foods we value. Right now, a real driver of waste is our superficiality and how we really crave food that looks perfect. But it's gotten to the point where appearance often trumps taste. And in my mind, that's just so wrong. So we need to get away from that idea.
Give us an example of a food in particular that really suffers from that superficiality you're speaking about.
The classic example that comes to my mind is the display of apples at the supermarket, where not only is every apple perfect, but it's the same size and shape. And anything that is slightly blemished will be called out. And I worked at a supermarket in the produce department as part of this research, and I spent a good portion of my day just going through those displays and taking out anything that didn't look quite right and throwing it out. Another thing that really pops up is something like cucumbers, where anything that is slightly curved, not perfectly straight, that won't make it off the farm.
I lived in Japan for quite some time, and the Japanese are famous for their packaging, and I couldn't help but notice how they would individually styrofoam wrap each of these enormous apples and peaches, and yes, they cost $4 or $5 each, but you could see the TLC that was in each one. Is that more wasteful or less wasteful a distribution chain?
Well, it's an interesting question. The packaging issue really comes up where it's kind of opposed to waste. The more packaging you have, the less waste you'll probably have. At the same time, you're producing all that paper and styrofoam that then gets thrown out. It's an interesting one. I tended to err on the side of less food waste, and so more packaging is a little bit more palatable to someone like me, but I've definitely talked to people who are on the other side of the equation. But have no fear, that individual wrapping of fruit is coming to the United States. I just heard they're doing it with bananas, or will be, so.
With the increasing popularity of places like Whole Foods, you see these enormous displays of produce as far as the eye can see, all perfectly uniform, and we've come to expect that in a lot of ways, and that has a downside, doesn't it?
It does. And basically, to have that kind of immaculate display, there's a tremendous amount of waste that's happening further down the food chain and at every step of the food chain before you get to that supermarket display. So that is something I'm trying to combat. It's kind of tricky to get people to change their opinions on how they approach food. And I understand that if you're in the supermarket and there's a perfect banana and one with a little black spot, you're going to take the perfect one. But at the same time, that doesn't mean the one with one blemish is trash. And there are many uses for that, whether it's selling it at a discount or making banana bread or what have you from it. You alone are the living thing that keeps me alive. And tomorrow, if I'm here without your love, you know I can't survive. Only my love. Only my love can raise you high above it all. Don't throw it all away, our love, don't throw it all away, our love. Don't throw it all away, our love, don't throw it all away, our love.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. My guest is Jonathan Bloom. He's a freelance journalist and food waste expert whose new book is American Wasteland. Let's talk about some of the inefficiencies in restaurants. You worked in a McDonald's. It's the largest, most successful restaurant chain in history. And I assume that they have thought of a lot of ways to cut corners. What are some of the things that you saw that could be improved in terms of waste?
Well, fast food chains have certainly improved in how much they waste, but there's still a fair amount built in where they're basically cooking a certain number of patties every hour, and then they're assembling the sandwiches as they're ordered. They're not just assembling them without orders coming in. But inevitably, at the end of that hour, they're going to have things that they have to throw out, and the largest source of waste came from the French fries, actually, and a tremendously quick half-life for French fries, about 7 minutes. There's actually a sign printed above the fry station that every 7 minutes you have to toss out that batch and cook a new one. And customers are definitely aware of that. And essentially, I've had many people, when I was working there, I had many people request hot fries. You know, they didn't want these ones. And that's just trash. It's disposable. And I suppose, given the price and the speed, it's not unreasonable that people would have that opinion of that food. But it is still food.
And when you say throw out, does it depend on the community whether or not they have an active composting program or not?
Well, the majority of towns and cities in the U.S. don't have any kind of composting program. It's just backyard composting. So, most of the food that is thrown out in America ends up in a landfill, which is not a good site for it. It rots and emits methane and essentially is aiding global warming. But just to look at the waste stream from a statistical standpoint, 97% of all the food waste produced in America is just sent to landfills. So you can flip that around and say we're composting about 3%. Plenty of room for improvement there. That's something that I think we'll really see improve and increase over the years.
Do you think rising oil prices may be a big stimulant to lowering our waste on a global level?
Because oil prices are going up, it's only natural that food prices will rise because there's so much oil embedded in the food chain. It's really at every step from the fertilizer we use to harvesting and processing, shipping across country in many cases, to cooling, even cooking. And then after we're done with that food, hauling it off to the landfill. So the food chain is certainly oil rich. And as that becomes more expensive, the food prices will only rise. The short answer is that as we pay more for food, we're probably going to value it more. I think that'll be a slow process, but you never know with the way food prices have been going up.
I'm a little afraid to ask this, but why don't we take a few steps from my home studio over to my refrigerator so you can give me a tip or two on some basic ways to make my fridge a less wasteful place.
The number one thing I'd say would just be to try to put the newer foods in back and push the older foods to the front so that you are actually eating stuff before it goes bad. And some people I've seen where they'll have a shelf of kind of like things that they need to use up before too long. So the use it up shelf is pretty popular. What really drives me crazy is like during Thanksgiving where you eat and then the carcass will just sit out for hours as people are, you know, having pie and watching football and whatever. But making a little bit of an effort to get that stuff in the fridge quicker, whether it's after dinner or even after you've gone grocery shopping, I think that will help reduce waste and save you money as well.
Well, it's a fascinating read. American Wasteland, my guest has been Jonathan Bloom. He's a food waste expert. Jonathan, thanks so much for being on Sea Change Radio.
Hey, thanks for having me. This was fun. Anytime I get to dig into someone's fridge, it's a good day.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Potato Valdez, Oscar the Grouch, and Andy Gibb.
Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Sungevity Home Solar Specialists and Incredible Adventures, an eco-friendly outdoor travel company. Go to incadventures.com to learn more. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.